From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Federal money, teachers' unions, and education reform. Hello again, I'm Oren Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Obama is dangling $4.3 billion in stimulus money to promote charter schools, merit pay, and standardized tests for evaluating teachers. He says states with laws against such evaluations won't get any money, which rules out New York and California. Even in other states, Education Secretary Arne Duncan could be up against opposition from teachers' unions, a major force in the Democratic Party. Will the prospect of all that money turn the unions around? What's the future of what the president calls race to the top? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Microsoft and Yahoo join forces against Google. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. The Obama administration's inviting the states to race to the top by competing for $4.3 billion in stimulus money for education reform. Is that enough to get teachers' unions to change their minds on charter schools, merit pay, or standardized tests to evaluate teacher performance? On Reporter's Notebook, Yahoo and Microsoft have struck a deal. Can they make a dent in Google's dominance of the market for internet searching? First is news update, as President Obama held another town hall meeting today on health care reform, this one in North Carolina with another planned later in Virginia. Rebellious House Democrats say they have reached an agreement with their own leadership and with the White House. Jeffrey Young reports on health care for The Hill. That's a newspaper that covers the Senate and Congress. Jeffrey Young, good to have you on our program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
What, in fact, have the Blue Dog Democrats agreed to?
Well, for the time being, it seems that the most important part of the agreement is that they're going to go ahead with the committee vote, which has been delayed for more than a week because of their objections. It's not really clear to me right now what promises were made and accepted on substance in terms of what their what their complaints were. But enough of those Democrats, those Blue Dog Democrats who were protesting, have agreed to allow the chairman, Henry Waxman, from California, to go ahead and finish the committee's work by the end of the week, which in theory would allow the House to vote finally on the legislation when it returns from its August recess, which begins on Friday.
Here's a quote from Mike Ross, Democrat from Arkansas. He says, "We cut the cost of the bill, delayed a floor vote, and ensured that the public option will not be forced on anyone. Now," he says, "members will have to get time to go home and talk to their constituents and actually read the bill." Now, that does sound like a recipe for delay.
Well, if you keep in mind that that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi went to the White House back in May, I believe, and stood next to the president on camera along with Mr. Waxman and the chairman of two other House committees who have already now finished their work on this bill, and promised the president that she would have their version of the bill passed out of the House by July 31st, it's pretty clear that there's no other word for it than delay.
And that's the work of the Blue Dogs, not the Republicans, because the Democrats have enough votes to get this through. What's happening at the same time over in the Senate?
Well, the Senate is, as it usually is, moving a little more slowly on certain fronts. Over the course of the last 6 months or so, Senator Max Baucus, who's from Montana and is the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, has been trying to find a way to get a bill out of his panel that has support from Democrats and Republicans. It's hard enough in any case, and on an issue this big, it's proved to be particularly difficult. However, today Senator Baucus came out of a morning meeting he had with the five other senators, two other Democrats, and three Republicans who he's been working most closely with, and said that a draft version of the bill that they haven't quite agreed to yet, but appear to be getting closer, received a cost estimate from the Congressional Budget Office showing that it had the lowest price tag so far of any of the bills coming out of Congress at less than $900 billion in new spending. And that not only did the cost-cutting measures in the bill and some tax increases fully pay for the bill over 10 years, Senator Baucus said that in the 10th year of that period, the government will actually spend less on health care than it does now.
And the White House,
rather than it was projected to spend in that same year.
I understand what you're saying. And the White House is saying that it wants whatever happens to come in under $1 trillion over 10 years. So apparently they've met that that standard.
With some wiggle room, in fact, which I didn't exactly expect.
Yeah.
Because often when Congress is assembling a bill, they start with how much they want to spend on it, and they fill the policy in from there. It's unusual, I think, to say the least, for them to target and say $1 trillion and then actually say they're going to spend $100 billion less when they could have used that money to buy more stuff. But in this case, I think that because there's so much demand among moderate Democrats, not to mention Republicans, and at least rhetorically from the White House, to show the public that they're trying to do as much as they can to cut health care spending and to take as much of the waste and inefficiency that in the system that already exists out of it before spending new government money, that symbolically, if nothing else, coming in under the budget target they set for themselves, you know, could make it look like that those efforts have been fruitful.
We heard a reference there from Mike Ross to the public option, so-called. What appears to be happening to that?
Well, here's where we are so far. The Senate Health Committee, which shares jurisdiction with the Finance Committee over this bill, they finished up their version of the bill, or their portion of the bill, I should say, a couple of weeks ago. That one has a big public plan in it, something run and managed by the government, although it would have to abide by, according to that legislation, the same insurance rules as a private company and wouldn't receive ongoing federal money. That is, it'd have to be financed by premiums. The House bill, as currently written, has a very similar structure in it. That may be changed to placate the blue dogs. It's not entirely clear to me in what way it would be changed, since most House Democrats continue to support something like that. The Finance Committee is going in an entirely different direction, one that doesn't make liberals happy at all, but might be just enough to win over some Republicans and keep the moderate Democrats on board and give them enough support to get the bill through the Senate, which usually needs 60 votes and will in this case.
Okay, we're not going to have time to hear the details of that. Our listeners, though, can find them. And obviously, this is an ongoing process, and we will follow it. Jeffrey Young on the Hill, many thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
In a moment, federal money, teachers' unions, and education reform on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warm and only back with To the Point. President Bush authored No Child Left Behind. Now President Obama has his own plan for education reform, and he calls it Race to the Top.
Because improving education is central to rebuilding our economy, we set aside over $4 billion in the Recovery Act to promote improvements in schools. This is one of the largest investments in education reform in American history. And rather than divvying it up and handing it out, we are letting states and school districts compete for it. That's how we can incentivize excellence and spur reform and launch a race to the top in America's public schools.
Michelle McNeil is a reporter for Education Week magazine. She has been traveling this week with the Education Secretary, Arne Duncan. He, of course, from Denver and ultimately from Chicago. And Michelle McNeil, it's good to have you on our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What strings are attached in order to compete? What do states have to do?
Well, I'll tell you, they have to jump through a lot of hoops. On Friday, we heard the president and then the Education Secretary Duncan outline just what states are going to have to do if they want to compete for this money. And all told, there are 19 criteria if states want to try to get a piece of this money. And these criteria range from, you know, do states have a good charter school law? Do they provide a lot of money for charter schools? Are states doing a good job of helping low-performing schools, and do states have buy-in from their teachers' unions? There are a lot of different criteria that are going to go into who the administration decides is worthy of this race to the top money. So there are a lot of strings attached. Now, once states get the money, they're going to get to use it for the education reform proposals that they put in their grant application. So there's a lot of strings going into it, but there's a lot of latitude on the part of states on how they will use the money if they win it.
You mentioned charter schools and teachers' unions. Teachers' unions aren't necessarily favorably inclined toward charter schools. They also have problems with a couple of other major provisions among those 19 criteria. One is for merit pay for teachers, and the other is for the use of national standards to evaluate the performances of teachers and principals, too. What kinds of problems are being raised?
Well, one of the criteria is that in order for states to be eligible for this money, they have to be able to use teachers and their data and compare that to how their students are doing on standardized tests. And that's one of the absolute criteria. And some states, including California and New York, have laws on the books that in one way or another prohibit linking student achievement data to teachers. And so this competition would mean that those states are out of the running for the money. And so this is the administration's way of leveraging this money to try to get change and to try to get teachers' unions more on board with using test scores as a measure, you know, of their own performance. And teachers, of course, are reluctant to do this. You know, would you want your performance, your salary to be judged, you know, on a student test score? So there is a lot of reluctance out there, and the administration is trying to use this $4 billion competition to get teachers' unions, you know, to change.
There has been some really strong language used by Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, when he was in California. He referred to the law in this state, which, as you say, prohibits the use of the data for the judging of teachers. And he said that was mind-boggling.
Yeah, he has not minced words. And in fact, when I was with him yesterday, he was speaking to a foundation and he told people in the crowd again that what's going on in California kind of defies common sense. So he has used strong words, and that's kind of part of his campaign is to use rhetoric to try to get the public on his side, to use this competition to try to bully states into changing their ways. And so far some states are doing the things that he wants. So it'll be interesting to see how California responds and how some other states respond.
I have to tell our listeners in California and around the country as well, we tried to get teachers' unions, both the state unions in California, which appear to be responsible for that law that you mentioned, and local districts, particularly the Los Angeles Unified District, which is the second largest in the United States, tried to get the unions from to appear on our program today, and they didn't do that. They just simply weren't available, which is fairly unusual for them. Michelle McNeil, are the teachers' unions kind of lying low on this?
Well, you bring up a really interesting point because I think that unions are in a difficult position. You know, they want to seem supportive of reform. They, of course, want to do what's best for kids, but this is also one of those really important issues to their members. So they're kind of caught in the middle. You know, I think the national representatives from the national unions, you know, the people who are working in D.C. for the unions see that the reform is moving in this way. It's just the, you know, local unions who are made up of teachers on the ground who are working in classrooms, you know, this is still a really tough issue for them to get around. So I think that they're, I do think in some ways they are laying low.
It's also difficult, one would assume, to come out opposing the competition for all of that money.
Well, exactly. States are in really tough shape right now with their budgets, and $4 billion is a lot of money. You know, even divided up, that's going to be a lot of money for a lot of states, and those states could really use that money, as could their schools. So, again, it's another tricky position to be in because, you know, teachers ultimately do want their states to get a piece of this money as well.
Michelle McNeil, again, is a reporter for Education Week. Let's go now to the one union we were able to get on our program, and it's significantly located in Chicago. The president of the Chicago Teachers Union is Marilyn Stewart. And, Ms. Stewart, thank you very much for being on our program.
You're welcome.
Is there, amongst not only other unions around the country, but yours as well, real concern about charter schools, about merit pay, about the use of test data to judge teachers?
Well, which did you want me to tackle first?
All three of them.
Well, the We're not against reform. People have to realize that teachers' unions are not against educational reform. This is our profession. This is our business. When people outside of education come in to try to make educational policy without involving the teachers, that's a recipe for failure. Everywhere, the districts around the country, everywhere there's been collaboration, and I know for a fact in Chicago, when Arnie Duncan collaborated with the union, we've seen success. And that's what we're promoting. And then on a national level, we want stimulus money. We have to realize this is only seed money. And I think we can't spend it willy-nilly. We have to, we want to have programs that help our students, that are fair to teachers. It has to be transparent to the public. And we want to know if it's going to require a shared responsibility in this. As far as for merit pay, we have the TAP program that has a professional compensation in it, but it's differentiated pay. When people talk about merit pay, that's a business model. As if all of the students are the same, and we're putting them on a assembly line and painting them all blue. We have children that come to school with a myriad of different issues and challenges. Teachers, absolutely, we support differentiated compensation. You're doing something and you get compensated for it. We're not opposed to having some test data in there, but the single test should not be the only part of how you evaluate a teacher. In Illinois, they're trying to put some structure into trying to put together some longitudinal data that would assist this, but that's years out in getting the vehicle that they want to use to evaluate teachers. We have the Fresh Start schools. We have eight schools where we have a mere assistance, peer assistance, and evaluation, and we've seen that to be successful in mentoring our teachers and trying to get better teachers. When you talk about merit pay, people are thinking that teachers are have a bag of tricks and they're holding them back, waiting for somebody to give them a little something. Say, oh, you're going to give me a little extra money, and I'm going to pull out a bag of tricks that I've been holding for 20 years, and I've just decided now to give it because you've given me a little something extra. Education does not work like that.
So what you're saying then is that these goals may be laudable, but they're very difficult to achieve. And in some cases, according to you, they are inappropriately administered when systems are devised.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, you have collaboration works. We know what children need to learn. And I think it's almost, my analogy was like education is filled with right-brain people and people that are making policy are left-brain, and they're data-driven. They're saying, if you show me the data, and we're saying that if you give me the support I need to educate this child in all the things that I need, then we can give you the data that you define success will show you. So we're saying that we need the support, and people can't, everybody comes out with a soundbite. Education is more than a soundbite. We're talking about the education of our children, education of our future. And with competition, we're only competing for funds that are limited funds. This stimulus money is seed money. We have to figure out a way to sustain public education and raise the bar for all of our students and our teachers. We're not opposed, as I said before, we're not opposed to educational reform. Teachers' unions promote reform and stability in our schools.
Does it make sense to have laws like there are in California and New York that prohibit the use of standardized tests for evaluating teachers, or are there ways that you can compromise on that, as I believe you have in Illinois?
Well, using test data only is a problem because you don't have the same test, you're not measuring the same things, and so I think that's a problem. You're taking one moment in time on one day and in a week, and then you're just going to decide what a child's score is and evaluate a teacher on that particular model. When educators realize that education is from the cradle through college, and so it's a continuum. It's not just one moment in a child's time. When we have the high mobility of our students, and there's a high mobility in some of our school districts, and so test data used to help improve teaching, but not be punitive. That's what teachers want. Test to be used for. Now teachers are inundated with all we're doing is teaching to the test, and we're not educating our students, which is absolutely a sin.
Marilyn Stewart, again, president of the Chicago Teachers Union. Quickly back to Michelle McNeil on this issue of seed money. $4.3 billion sounds like a lot of money until you're talking about the entire United States and all of the school systems in it. If it does sound like a small amount of money, why is so much attention being paid to it?
I think so much attention is being paid to it is because Secretary Duncan wants to use this money as kind of a big carrot to dangle in front of states to get them to change their laws, to get them to be more welcoming to charter schools, to get them to embrace merit pay. So he's using it kind of as a carrot to leverage change. So I think it's more about what's happening now in trying to get states to move in different directions than simply just about money. So I think that's why it's important.
Once again, Arne Duncan was the superintendent of schools in Chicago, and charter schools were established there. Elizabeth Purvis is executive director of the Chicago International Charter School. It runs 12 charter campuses in the Chicago area. And Elizabeth Purvis, welcome to you.
Thank you.
How would you respond to some of the points raised by Marilyn Stewart about the charter schools, about merit pay, about the use of test data to evaluate teachers?
Well, I think Ms. Stewart made some very good points in that although I am a firm believer in merit pay for teachers, I think it is only as good, merit pay is only good as the system that is built, and that nobody's compensation or should be based on one single aspect of their job. So for us, when we think about merit pay, we look at a myriad of factors. So we look at the quality of the environment the teacher has in their classroom. We look at student gain scores from the beginning of the school year to the end of the school year based on individual student targets. But it's very important that that the merit pay structure is well thought out, is communicated well with teachers, that teachers have input on that system, and that it is a very transparent system.
What about charter schools themselves? What's the advantage of having a charter school?
Well, I think it's always important to say that charter schools are one part of a global reform effort, not the only part of global reform. And I think if you look at Secretary Duncan's history here in Chicago, it was one piece of his overall reform efforts. But for me, what is most important, and I think what we've proven in our schools and in others, is that the autonomy given to teachers and to educators in charter schools allows for innovation, allows us to move quickly when things aren't working, and allows us to do things like set a school day and school year that is focused on what kids need most, which is more time, more instructional time in classrooms.
In your charter schools, your 12 campuses, how many of them are unionized?
There are three that are unionized.
And what's the difference between those and the others?
The three that are unionized, the teachers just voted to form a union within the last 2 months. So there's negotiations to work on the contract for that. So we haven't had a year in which we've had a union in the school. So I can't answer that question yet.
One of the things that people say is good about charter schools, or some people do, who don't like the teachers' unions, is that you don't have to have them. But I take it you're going to have both.
We are going to have both.
Okay, Elizabeth Purvis again, Executive Director of the Chicago International Charter School with 12 charter school campuses in the Chicago area. We'll come back, talk further with her, Marilyn Stewart of the Chicago Teachers Union, and Arthur Rothkopf, who is with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, an organization that's taken a lot of interest in education reform. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, Microsoft and Yahoo join forces to challenge Google. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. You're talking today about the president's school reform program called Race to the Top, which is to encourage states to compete for $4.3 billion. He says that's more than has ever been used for this purpose before, the purpose of which, we have heard, is to force change, to provide a carrot to cause change state by state, particularly with regard to encouraging charter schools, merit pay for teachers, and the use of tests to evaluate teachers and their performance. Arthur Rothkopf is Senior Vice President responsible for Education and Workforce Programs at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He's past president of the Lafayette College in Pennsylvania. And Arthur Rothkopf, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, it's great to be here, Warren.
Have the teachers' unions in various states around the country been obstacles to the kind of reforms that you'd like to see?
Well, I think it's a problem not just of teachers' unions. In many cases, it's the unions as well as school boards who have a stake in the status quo. Frankly, we see it as not enough impact and attention being paid to the children, more being paid to the adults in the system. And frankly, we welcome what the president has had to say, what Secretary Duncan and the Race to the Top guidelines, because we think they represent a reform agenda that has the potential for enormous positive impact on student achievement, which is something that's critical not just to the students as they hopefully not only graduate from high school but move on to post-secondary education, but also to the competitiveness position of the United States in international markets. So, yes, there've been obstacles by those who are committed to the status quo, who really don't want change because they're protecting their position. But the key here is to focus on the children and their achievement and their goals, and we think that the president and Arne Duncan have it exactly right.
Just before we go forward with these details, elaborate a little bit on what you mean by the need for a competition. What's at stake for the Chamber of Commerce?
What's at stake for the Chamber of Commerce and really for American business? And remember, it's American business that ultimately employs the vast bulk of those who graduate from school. So it's not some abstract corporation out there. It's those individuals and kids who are graduating from school and looking for jobs. We are competing today. The kids in the Chicago school system are not just competing with other kids who graduate from schools in Illinois or Indiana or Ohio. We are now competing with, and they're competing with youngsters who graduate from schools in Singapore and Korea and China and India, because it is a global marketplace that is not going to change. It's a matter of talent and knowledge and skills. And if our young people do not graduate with the skills that they need, not only are they going to suffer, but U.S. Is going to suffer in its competition for business, which is now a worldwide enterprise. So we can't look at this as a sort of a local matter all about Cook County. It's not about Cook County. It's about a world market in which our young people have got to graduate both career ready and college ready. And frankly, that has not been happening. Way too many of our youngsters are dropping out of high school. Nationally, it's about 30%, but when you go to cities, it can be 50% or higher, and that's just a scandal that has got to stop. So the status quo is not an answer. What we need is the kind of reform agenda that the President and Secretary of Education has put forward, and I can say that we at the U.S. Chamber and the business community and many other reform-minded groups are strongly behind it. Our concern is, will there be follow-through? It's great to put these great rules out there, but will politics interfere, and will the race to the top rules not be administered in the way in which we think they were intended to be?
Arthur Rothkopf again with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Marilyn Stewart, back to you, president of the Chicago Teachers Union. What do you say when those kinds of phrases are used, that people object to reform because they have a stake in the status quo and they want to protect adults rather than being sufficiently concerned about children?
Well, I've been a teacher in Chicago. I'm a product of Chicago Public Schools, and I taught in the system for 30 years before becoming president. And so I think it's absurd for people to think that any educator would have a vested interest in incompetence. President Obama himself said unions are part of the solution and not the problem. Arne Duncan came to me long before he became Secretary of Education, back in maybe 2004, and said, "Marilyn," he came to my office, "Marilyn, you know, why don't you unionize the charter schools? What do I need to do to help change some Illinois laws for the CTU, Chicago Teachers Union, can unionize charter schools?" The unions started the charter movement. We're not opposed to that. We're absolutely focused on the education of our children and creating stability in education. The top schools in Chicago, the top schools in the state of Illinois, are unionized public schools. And people, they want to gloss over that. Unions have never been obstacles to education. We've been obstacles to people trying to, you know, coming in and just, you know, creating havoc by not supporting what teachers know is right for students. So I think I think it doesn't do anyone any service by having a blame game when we're saying we're here for the long haul. I've had a profession for 30 years in special education in the city of Chicago, and we've seen governors change and mayors change and school boards change and presidents change, and the union and the teachers in the system have been consistent having to work with this top down model. Arne Duncan and I have collaborated, and where we've collaborated, we've seen success. And all we're asking is that he needs to, you know, I'm going to suggest to him that he say that when he goes out to talk about lifting the caps on charters, but I absolutely agree that teachers have a vested interest in having a voice in the educational process. This is what we do. And I think it's, you know, when people come from the outside with people with education, saying that, well, I have an education, I can dictate educational policy, is absolutely disrespectful to this the profession that I love so dearly. Unions are, we're a teachers club. If unions is a sore point for people, we're a teachers club. And I think you have to, you cannot take the person out of the teacher out of the from the classroom and from the student. Students are absolutely first on our priority list. The education of all of our students in the public, in all of our schools in the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois. This is what we're fighting for. And if we have, you know, and this is what we live for, and we've dedicated our lives to. So we want to be part of the solution, and we're not the problem, and we're absolutely not obstacles to change. We're seeing so much change that we're saying, look, we need stability now. We're promoters of stability and in the educational lives of our students.
Marilyn Stewart again, president of the Chicago Teachers Union. Back to Elizabeth Purvis, executive director of the Chicago International Charter School, which runs 12 charter campuses in Chicago. You too are a former union teacher. You don't want to play the blame game, neither do I. But is there some truth in the argument that teachers have, or the teachers' unions, perhaps not in Chicago but elsewhere, have stood in the way of reforms of the kinds that are needed?
Unfortunately, I think the answer to that is yes. And I think we can look, even at things as simple here in Chicago as length of the school day. The empirical data tells us that the most important thing for kids is the number of minutes they have in school. And here in Chicago, the school day is 5 hours and 40 minutes long. That's not long enough for kids who are 2, 3, and 4 grade levels behind. And I think we need to think about some of the things the charter schools bring forward. One part that I will say about Chicago is that although the top-performing schools in Chicago are union-led schools, when you look at the top-performing high schools that are non-selective, therefore you don't have to test into those. In terms of ACT and graduation rates and college placement rates, charter schools are at the top of those lists. So I think that we need to look at the fact that parents need choices, students need choices, and that charter schools and charter-like schools push innovation in a school system like Chicago.
Arthur Rothkopf, back to you. Let's get to beyond Chicago and talk about other states. New York and California have laws that say that you can't use test data to make assessments of teachers and judge their performance. So, what about other states? And is this competition that the president and Arne Duncan have set up having making any progress as yet?
Well, I think it's too soon to tell. Remember, these rules just came out on Friday, but the secretary has been talking about it. I think there are states like California, New York, on the subject of not being able to link pay in any way to student performance. I think you'll find states changing those rules. There's another requirement in the race to the top guidance, which again Secretary had talked about, and that is you're not allowed to have any caps or prohibitions, either statutory or regulatory, on charter schools. And he identified some states. Give you one example. Tennessee, I believe, is changing its rules. They used to prohibit charter schools or limit them. They are now in the process, or have already voted to permit charter schools because they want a shot at the race to the top money. And as one of your previous speakers said, this is he's not forcing people to do anything. He's just simply saying, if you want to get a shot at this federal money, then you've got to conform to certain reform principles, which he and the president have said is important. We think he's right on that. So change, I believe, will take place. these legislators who said, gee, you can't link pay and student achievement, they may have to look at it and say, well, gee, are we willing to give up a shot at some piece of $4 billion, and particularly California, where you have the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the head of the Education Committee in the House, George Miller. Are they going to say, gee, we don't want any of this money? I don't think so. I think someone's going to take a hard look at it and say, yep, we ought to get, have an opportunity to compete.
Arthur Ruthkopf with the Chamber of Commerce. Michelle McNeil, back to you, our reporter for Education Week magazine. You have been traveling with Arnie Duncan, and he has been on the road a lot of late. What sort of reactions are you getting?
Well, it depends from whom. Mostly people are really excited about the possibility of this money. People are excited that the president is talking about education. You've got states, as Arthur was already talking about, who are already making changes so they could be at a competitive advantage.
Which states, other than Tennessee?
Colorado is using part of their stimulus money to advance some of the reforms that the administration has specifically talked about. Indiana has taken out some language that restricted using teacher, linking that student data and teacher data. Indiana is also coming out with a big teacher quality initiative. So people are trying to get in line for this. Mostly, I think people are excited. They see money out there. Money is desperately needed right now. And so I think it's being met with a lot of enthusiasm, although a lot of questions still remain about how it's going to be implemented. And the devil's always in the details.
It's going to be implemented, though, differently in each state, is it not?
That's true, but the question Arthur raised earlier, which is, how is the Department of Education going to award these in terms of, who's going to judge these applications that states turn in? Who's going to ultimately decide who gets this money? How many states are going to get the money? Maybe it'll be 10, maybe it'll be 20. If you start giving out a lot of money, money to a lot of states, the amount of money gets diluted. The money is going to be given out in two phases. So who's going to get the money in the first phase? Who's going to get the money in the second phase? And are there going to be states that just think this is too hard and don't apply at all? So there are still a lot of questions out there.
And Arthur Ruthkopf, with all of the differences there are between the states and between localities and local school districts within states, what about the argument that it's not a good idea to plunk down a cookie-cutter kind of national reform that applies to every state? How do you come up with just and reasonable differences as you try to assess each of these states with them competing for this money?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and I'm not sure it's going to be a cookie-cutter approach. As I think Michelle indicated, there are 19 criteria here, and I'm not sure anybody's going to get an A on all 19. There'll be some A's and some B's and maybe even some C's in there. But one of the things we haven't talked about is the fact that Arne Duncan has indicated in his speeches that there'll be preference given to consortia of states who come in with, for example, coming in and say, well, we're going to get to develop some common standards, some common assessments, some common data systems. So you could have a group of states just hypothetically in the Southeast, or the New England states who already work together can come together. We're probably the only country, only industrialized country in the world that does not have common standards. Most countries that we're competing with, industrialized countries, do have them. And we're clearly moving in that direction. 46 states recently promised under the initiative of the National Governors Association, the Chief State School Officers, to look to develop common standards. And then ultimately, Duncan has indicated there's going to be money available to develop common assessments. So like it or not, we may be moving in the direction, at least in education, of greater commonality across state lines. And I know there'll be people who are devoted to local control who are going to be unhappy about it. But frankly, we think that's a direction we may need to go.
Arthur Ruthkopf with the Chamber of Commerce. Marilyn Stewart, back to you with the Chicago Teachers Union. Will Illinois, as far as you know, be competing for some of this money?
Yes, they absolutely will be competing for this money. But we're going to use the same criteria that the AFT, you know, was going to use to judge these funds, and as I said before, will be make sure these programs help students and they're fair to teachers and transparent to the public, and that, you know, to see if shared responsibility is required. And so this is like a litmus test for us to make sure the funds are used appropriately.
Are you worried that there's a sort of anti-union aspect to all of this, despite what the president and Arne Duncan have said?
It's unfortunate that, you know, that there is an anti-union prospect, and when our goal is to educate our students, and we're fighting for transparency, as Ms. Purvis has talked about with the charter schools. We in Illinois, we lifted the cap on charters in Illinois long before this race to the top funds was announced. And we had to fight to change the laws in Illinois to get charter campuses to report their scores by individual campuses and not combine their scores and report them like that. They have selective.
Let me go back to Elizabeth Purvis. What about that? Is there a kind of preference for charter schools such as yours? Will Arne Duncan and others effectively be trying to make them look better?
I hope not. I hope what Arne Duncan and others will do is try to look at each school individually and see the value-added growth at each school for students. I think that we have to remember that the product of schools is student learning, so that I'm hoping that the race to the top funds and the innovation funds, part of that will push all of us in education, be them union, non-union schools, to just provide high-quality education, instruction and curriculum that are data-driven, and that at the end of the day, we can say to a parent, your child started at place X, they ended at place Y, and that's exactly where they should be. So I'm hoping that all schools are held to the same accountability standards.
Michelle McNeil, a final question to you. Mr. Rothkopf mentioned that California has enormous power in Washington with the Speaker of the House, the Chair of the Education Committee of the House, George Miller. And I'm wondering, are they coming down on this at all, given the fact that California has a law now that will make it ineligible to even compete for this money? Or are they trying to get the legislators, their former colleagues in Sacramento, to change the law?
Oh, I think the latter is more the case. Representative George Miller, I think the chairman of the House Education Committee, put out a statement urging, the folks in Sacramento to work on this legislation to improve it.
And is that happening in New York as well?
New York? That's a good question. I'm actually not as sure about that.
And of course, they don't have the Speaker of the House or the Chair of the Education Committee. Well, thank you all very much for being with us today. Michelle McNeil, once again, is a reporter for Education Week magazine. She's been traveling with the Education Secretary, Arne Duncan. Arthur Rothkopf is with the Education and Workforce Program of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, formerly the president of Lafayette College in Pennsylvania. Marilyn Stewart is president of the Chicago Teachers Union, and Elizabeth Purvis is executive director of the Chicago International Charter School with 12 campuses in the Chicago area. Many thanks to all of you for being with us today. Last year, Microsoft made a hostile bid to buy Yahoo for $48 billion. Didn't work. But today, the two companies agreed to a partnership. Could be good for both companies, but the primary target appears to be Google. More on that in a moment on To The Point.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To The Point.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. Google is the colossus of Internet searching, and its dominance likely will continue. But today's deal between Microsoft and Yahoo is designed to slow Google down. Todd Bishop is managing editor of TechFlash.com. That's in Seattle. And Todd Bishop, good to have you on our program.
Oh, thanks, Warren. It's a pleasure to be here.
How is this deal different from the takeover that Microsoft proposed of Yahoo a year ago?
Well, Microsoft, as you imply, was going to take over Yahoo in whole, everything from its instant messaging service to its website portal to its search deal. Through this search arrangement, the companies are essentially just agreeing to collaborate. They're not even creating a separate entity per se. They're just agreeing to work together on Internet search and Internet advertising.
Is there a lot of money in it for either one of them?
Well, potentially. This is a booming market, and especially in the tough economy right now, Internet search ads, because they result in much more immediate click-throughs than things like banner ads, are a lot more desirable for advertisers. So this is a market that Microsoft has long aspired to do well in, but just has not. And it's become pretty clear that a deal such as this with Yahoo is one of the only ways that Microsoft is going to gain significant ground against Google.
So what's Microsoft going to do for Yahoo? What's Yahoo going to do for Microsoft?
Yeah, it's a great question because it is very nuanced behind the scenes. Essentially, Microsoft will be offering up its new Bing search engine to Yahoo to power Yahoo's search. And at the same time, Yahoo will be selling premium search ads, you know, the kind of search ads that people actually have to go to somebody else's office to sell. We're not talking about the automated auction process. Microsoft, on the other hand, will handle the automated auction process through what it's calling its Ad Center system. Now, at the same time, in all of this, Microsoft will be paying 88% of the revenues from the search ads that it serves up on Yahoo's site back to Yahoo. So there's a lot of complicated, nuanced stuff going on behind the scenes. But bottom line, Microsoft will have 30% of the search market share in the U.S. That gives it a much better position to try and attack Google, in its view.
How much does Google have?
Google has 65% of the search market share in the U.S. So even after this deal, Google is the colossus of the industry, as you said. And it just goes to show you how far behind Microsoft was before Microsoft announced this deal with Yahoo. And continuing, because there is still the need for regulatory approval, it has only 8% of the market.
This was just announced today, and there are already rumblings from Washington about the need for, not Washington State, but Washington, D.C., for the need for careful scrutiny. That's according to Herb Kohl, Wisconsin Democrat, who's chair of the Judiciary Committee. They're concerned about competition.
That's right. The other Washington is calling up here.
You got it.
They certainly are. And, you know, it's somewhat ironic because when Microsoft was initially planning to acquire Yahoo, Google stepped up and announced a search advertising and alliance with Yahoo itself to try and counteract Microsoft. That set in motion a lot of regulatory scrutiny back then, and some of that scrutiny could actually come back and set a precedent that will now be applied to Microsoft as it pursues its own search advertising deal with Yahoo. The big difference here, of course, is the market share. Microsoft, as we mentioned, through this would still only have 30%. Whereas if you had combined Google and Yahoo, you would have been pushing 90%, which is a monopoly in most anyone's eyes, even though those two companies said they had safeguards against that.
Still, if Google's got 65%, that's a pretty big share.
It is. And, you know, because of that, Microsoft probably has a much better chance of getting this through the regulators than Google did through its proposed partnership with Yahoo.
Well, what about people working at their computers? Do you think that this is going to lead to a major switch from Google to Bing and Yahoo? Is that what they're hoping for ultimately?
It is what they're hoping for ultimately. Microsoft's focus at this point, though, is more on the advertisers and giving them a choice and trying to become a more credible rival to Google in that way. You know, longer term, Microsoft says that could result in better innovation as it, you know, builds momentum through the search market, and then end users could see the results of that further innovation down the road. But right now, they're trying to appeal to advertisers and say, hey, with 30% of the market, we're going to have a lot more eyeballs for you to serve your ads up to.
On the other hand, that's less than half of what Google has. Why would somebody advertise for 30% of the market when they could get 65?
Very good point. The analysts I've spoken to this morning say that 35% or 30% is at least past the tipping point. It's probably too big for companies to ignore, whereas with Microsoft and Yahoo previously operating separately, particularly Microsoft with only 8% of the market, a company could have gotten away with ignoring it. But once you get up into the 30% range, that's enough of a critical mass that you really have to pay attention as an advertiser.
Now, 30 and 65 don't add up to 100. What other advertisers are there, and does any one of them have the ability to get big enough to compete with either the Bing-Yahoo combine or with Google?
Well, other search engines out there are Ask.com, the former Ask Jeeves, and AOL Search is also still a player in the market. It really depends on what happens with those companies. You know, Microsoft, even with all of its, you know, momentum from Windows and Office, had such a hard time competing against Google. that it would probably be even harder at this point for Ask or AOL or anyone else out there to do the same.
Has Wall Street as yet reacted to the partnership announced today?
Well, it certainly has. Yahoo so far is down in early trading. I haven't checked in the last hour, but they were down significantly in trading after the announcement. Microsoft was up slightly. So, you know, it clearly it looks like at least the market is saying that Microsoft might be the winner in this deal, if there is such a thing.
Microsoft's in Washington, Yahoo's in California. What about employment impacts?
Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer is saying that the company will put into new assignments anyone who is affected by Yahoo taking over these premium search ad sales. Carol Bartz from Yahoo said on the conference call this morning with analysts that there could be an impact there in terms of employment, especially as Microsoft takes over the underlying search technology for both companies. But at the same time, this is under such a long time frame. I mean, we're talking about the deal closing early next year and then the transition taking place gradually over the next few years after that. It's conceivable that Yahoo could do this through attrition.
Okay. Todd Bishop, that's all the time we have. TechFlash.com in Seattle. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.